Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts. I'm Allison Stewart. This is All of It, and we are going to continue with mythology. We just finished hearing about the new podcast Live from Mount Olympus, which brings stories from Greek mythology right into your earbuds. Now we turn to an author who has made a career of bringing figures from the classics to life as fully fleshed out characters. Madeline Miller's novel Circe, about one of the most powerful witches in mythology, is currently on top 10 paperback bestseller lists coast to coast, from the LA Times bestseller list to the Washington Post's. And Circe, Madeline draws on the life of Circe, who is best known for transforming most of Odysseus's crew into pigs in Homer's Odyssey. But in Madeline's novel, Circe becomes a woman struggling to form her own identity, harness her own powers, and escape from a troubling family legacy, and from men who might cause her harm or seek to diminish her abilities. Since I spoke to Madeline in 2018, Circe has become a bestseller and has been optioned for an 8-episode adaptation on HBO Max. Madeline Miller's always had a love of mythology. Her acclaimed debut novel was The Song of Achilles, and she has a bachelor's and master's degree in classics from Brown University. So I began our conversation by asking Madeline when she was first introduced to classical mythology.
My mother decided to read. She was not a classicist. She was an English major. But she loved the ancient myths, and so she decided to read me pieces of the Iliad and the Odyssey as a child and as bedtime stories. And now she's very embarrassed that I tell the story to people because she thinks it makes her sound really inappropriate. But I loved it. I absolutely just fell in love from the moment that she read that first line of the Iliad, you know, "Sing, goddess of the rage of Achilles." I was completely enraptured, and I just kept going.
I did want to ask about the inappropriateness of my son. We were sharing kids' stories earlier. Was at a camp, and the oxen's names were Zeus and Apollo. And I started to try to tell him the story, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not sure this is okay. Did that all go over your head, or did your mother like selectively edit?
I think she selectively edited. I'm pretty sure she skipped, you know, the gore and splatter of number of books of the Iliad. I think I might have gotten the whole Cyclops episode though, which is also, you know, a lot of gore.
That's a lot. What appealed to you about them, little you?
What appealed to little me is that I loved how incredibly exciting they were, but also how real they felt. That at the same time, they felt so larger than life and epic and exciting, but also so human. You know, Homer shows us these amazing battle scenes, but it's not just about glory. It's also about sort of the consequences of that. You know, he shows us the grieving families. He shows us the mothers who have lost children and the wives who have lost husbands. He shows us the broken bodies of the men. And so that was just incredibly powerful to me. I felt like, you know, all of life is in these stories.
What changed in your perspective now that you're an adult and you think about these stories and you think about the way you ingested them as a child? What's changed about the way you think about mythology?
I think now I'm really interested in the psychological aspects behind it. You know, I love to dig into these characters and sort of imagine personalities for them, you know, based on what we know. Homer has such an expansive and vivid world, but, you know, it's not really his project to kind of get into the inner psychology and inner thoughts of the characters. And so that's something that I love to do. And in the case of Circe, you know, I think the central mystery of her character is here she is on this island. She turns Odysseus's men into pigs, famously. Mm-hmm. Why? Why is she doing this? How did she get there? How did she get those kind of powers? This is not just, you know, there aren't just 10 witches, you know, all around Greece turning men to pigs. It's just her. How did that come to be? And so sort of being able to dig into them from that aspect. And when I was a child, I was also very rigid about the myths. I wanted them all to be, you know, exactly as I read them in whatever the myth book was that I read them. Mm-hmm. And I think as an adult, I've come to understand that, you know, these myths live because they are retold. And there is no such thing as a definitive myth. You can just tell them and tell them all through the centuries, and you should.
You create and recreate.
Yes.
When did you start to really think about the women in these stories rather than just like the action, the adventure, the psychology. Wait, there are women here.
Well, actually, so in terms of Cersei, this also goes back to my childhood, although a little bit later. I was 13 years old. I was in eighth grade. And in my school, everyone read the Odyssey when you were in eighth grade. So I had my first, you know, official translation that belonged to me. It was so exciting. I was making notes in the margins and highlighting. And it came to the Cersei episode. And I had heard a little bit about her because I studied myths, but I'd never really read it in translation. So here's Odysseus. He's been gone from Troy for 2 years trying to get home. In that time, he's lost 11 of his ships, all of his crew, except for what's on his one last ship. He's exhausted. He's grieving. He's broken. They land on the shore. His men go up to the house to explore it. They're taken in by this beautiful goddess who gives them food and wine, drugged wine, and turns them into pigs. And then here comes Odysseus, and he's going to come rescue them. And Odysseus has been given special herbs by Hermes to make him immune to Cersei's spells. So he goes up. And at this point in the story, my 13-year-old self was so excited because I thought, wow, here's a really interesting, smart, strong female character. And Odysseus, of course, is very smart, very clever. And this is going to be a real battle of wits. This is going to be a great scene. There's going to be fireworks. It's going to be awesome. So he comes in and she tries to cast her spell on him. It doesn't work. He pulls out his sword and she screams and falls to her knees and begs for mercy and invites him into her bed. And I just remember this intense feeling of disappointment. You know, they're actually, Homer is doing something very complicated with Cersei that he then goes on to, she does continue to be wise and interesting. But at that moment, what all I could see was just how quickly the lens had shifted away from her and back onto Odysseus. And everything was sort of filtered through the hero's story. And so I think that moment just stuck with me.
When you think about Circe and the whole grand mythology, what is her importance?
So she's most well known, as you said, for the Odyssey, but she has all these other relationships to Greek myths. So she's the daughter of the sun god Helios, and she is also the aunt of the Minotaur, the horrible half-bull, half-man monster. She's the aunt of the witch Medea, famous for killing her own children. She's the aunt of Ariadne. She's cousin to Prometheus and a whole host of other notable divinities. And so she really has this, and she creates monsters as well. So she has this whole life that has nothing to do with Odysseus. And, and that was something I was really fascinated by because, you know, we just get to see her as a cameo in Odysseus' story, but I wanted to kind of flip that. Now Odysseus is a cameo in her story.
It's this. The first line in your book is quoted in almost every review because it really sets the stage for who Circe is or what we're going to learn about Circe. And I'm going to read it to you if it's okay. You wrote it. I'll read it. When I was born, the name for what I was did not exist. They called me Nymph, assuming I would be like my mother and aunts and thousand cousins. Least of the lesser goddesses, our powers were so modest, they could scarcely ensure our entities, our eternities, excuse me. So the idea that there wasn't a name for what she was.
That she was in this incredibly limited society. You know, within the world of the gods, we often think about gods, Greek gods. We think about Zeus throwing thunderbolts, you know, Helios, the sun god, Athena, these major deities. And if you were one of those gods, life was pretty good for you. You got to do exactly what you wanted. You got to wreak terrible vengeance if someone offended you. You had everything the moment you wanted it, snap. But the ancient gods were also incredibly hierarchical. So if you were a nymph, you were way, way down. You were the last rung on the ladder, and you were basically a pawn or you were prey. And so I was interested in that she's born into this position of power, but actually she has no power at all. And her life is incredibly constricted. And really, the story is a story of a person who is rejecting that constriction.
I want to talk about her description as a witch. We were banding about this back upstairs in the office. Is she the first witch in the canon of Western literature?
She is. She is. And it's fascinating to look at her because you can see a lot of sort of witchy properties. She has animals. She's surrounded by tame lions and wolves. So she has kind of the animal power, like witch familiars. She has a wand. obviously potions, herbs, mm-hmm. poisons. She's good at all that stuff. But for me, I wanted to really separate her witchcraft from her divinity. You know, her divinity is something she was born with. Her witchcraft is something she does. Mm. She makes it. She wills it into being. She creates it through hard work and sort of strength of character and determination. And it seems to me, as I was sort of digging into the history of witches a little bit, that witch is the word we use for a woman who has more power than we think she should have.
We're speaking with Madeline Miller. She is the author of Circe, her latest novel. Now, a lot of people will remember your name from your first novel, The Song of Achilles. When you were going about researching, writing books like these, what's your process? I mean, we know the mythology, and then what for you as a writer?
So I have to, with both of these characters, and I'm an incredibly slow writer. Song of Achilles took me 10 years, and this one took me 7. And for me, so much of that time is spent developing the voice of the character and really trying to understand them from the inside out. Mm-hmm. So I write tons and tons and tons of pages, and I throw them all out, and then I write tons and tons more, and then I throw all those out. And then somewhere around the year 5 mark, I have a crisis where I think I'm never going to write this book. But then I take a little break, and I come back to it, and I have it. And it's there. It's sort of I need to go through this period of wandering in the woods for everything to gel and coalesce. And for me, the most important thing is really just being able to hear that character speak and, mm-hmm. and try and live inside their skin.
Have you had any pushback from some of the more parochial classicists who are like, how? You can't possibly give Circe a voice. You don't know Circe. I mean, I watched one interview from your first book, and the interviewer sort of started with their arms folded and was sort of challenging you on this. Tell me a little bit about the reaction that some of the more formal folks have had to your work.
You know, I think that you will always find, you know, a few people who think that these disciplines belong to them exclusively. But I really believe the classics is for everyone. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these old stories, you know, we tend to think of them as being a little bit elitist now, but these old stories were truly for everyone back in the day. You know, they were the stories that that grandparents would tell their grandchildren, that everyone knew. It didn't matter who you were. There's nothing I can do to Homer. He's fine. He's fine.
Homer's going to be just fine.
Yeah. So, but for the most part, actually, I've been very happily surprised. You know, when I was writing Song of Achilles, I was very worried about the classics police. Mm-hmm. I was sort of worried they were going to come up to my house and, you know, take me away in handcuffs. But I think most classicists know that, you know, these stories do live because we retell them, and they're incredibly supportive of people digging into them and approaching them and trying out new things.
Something that's happened early on in the book I found very powerful was that once Circe realizes she has this power to be a witch, she tries to tell her father, look, I can do this. And he says, no, you can't. Mm. But when her brother comes and says, yeah, we can do this, he believes the brother. Why was it important for you to make that part of the story?
I mean, I think it's the type of thing that plays out in so many women's lives. And, you know, I didn't want to make a big deal about it because it's just part of the fabric of her life that, you know, her father believes her brother over her, that her voice is not heard and that she's discounted. And, you know, it's just, it's always kind of bubbling in the background. And, you know, really this is the story of a woman who is finding her voice, finding her home, finding her place. Oftentimes she has to wrest it away from other people mm-hmm. Who don't want to give it to her. And so all that, I think, goes into women's experiences. I think I certainly know a lot of women who have had that type of experience, mm-hmm. myself included.
Was there a runner-up to Circe if you hadn't written the book about her?
No.
It was always her?
It was always Circe.
Why?
Oh,
that's so interesting.
I was really possessed by her character because she is so complex in a way that mm-hmm. a lot of ancient female characters aren't allowed to be. Oftentimes they get kind of shunted into the pure villains or, you know, the tragic saints. Usually, almost always, they die at the end of the story mm-hmm. or, you know, something terrible happens to them. They're there mostly for their role as the wife or the mother or the daughter, you know. But Circe has this complexity to her. She starts off being very menacing in the episode with Odysseus, but after he and she come to their understanding, mm-hmm. She becomes one of the most helpful deities that he encounters. She's incredibly wise. He stays on her island for a year, and actually he does not even want to leave at the end of the year. His men have to sort of give him a nudge and mm-hmm. say, okay, Odysseus, you know, it's time to get moving again. And he goes to her and says, it's time for me to go. She sends him on his way with the best possible advice. She gives him all this wisdom about how to get by the monsters and how to talk to shades in the underworld. And so I loved that, that duality was built into her, mm-hmm. you know, that she could be menacing, she could be friendly, and then this mystery of, you know, how did we get to the pigs?
I almost shouldn't ask this since you told me how long it took you to write the other two books. Is there any other character in Greek mythology you think you might be interested in?
Maybe. There's the other great love other than Homer is Virgil's Aeneid. And so I'm sort of sidling up to a possible story about that. But I also direct Shakespeare plays. And so The Tempest has been calling to me for a long time. So that has nothing to do with the ancient world at all. But it does have magic and islands.
That was my conversation with author Madeline Miller about her New York Times best-selling novel, Circe. The novel has been optioned for an 8-episode adaptation on HBO Max.